So, how are we now to think of the nature of the state as an institution? It's an artifact. It has a founding function that's historical formative, we people create states, and it has a leading function, that of justice. That's what it's formed in order to ensure. A state, then, we may define as a political institution in society, citizens organized under a government. But what more can we say about the state? That's what we get from its qualifying, its leading functions, with a distinction among the different aspects. There's also a matter of its type law. Remember that? For individuals, there are also laws that govern which combinations of parts and properties are possible in the creation. And so we now want to know what the type law for the state is. It's internal organization. And just about everyone who's ever written about the state agrees on this arrangement of parts. That is, everyone agrees that the state has to do with the relation of might, that is power, and right, that is justice. The state's the institution that is charged with establishing the legal order and then enforcing the legal order. So the type law is going to have to do something to do with the relation of might and right. And as you might expect, we're going to say, from a Christian point of view, that the right way to think of this type law is that there are organs of determining what is right, and there are organs of the exercise of might or power, and that it's the right that should lead the might. That is, the law determines what it is that will be compelled or forbidden, and the power of the state is used to enforce the law. Now, as with other institutions and other artifacts, it's possible for something to not conform to its type of law exactly. Say, a marriage has a type law that requires spouses who pledge love, exclusive love to one another. What happens then when one of the spouses doesn't fulfill that, doesn't seem to love the other, or is brutal or cruel? Is it no longer a marriage? Well, that calls for judgment. There are some cases in which, yes, that would be the conclusion. Others in which it would be, no, it's now a distorted marriage. It's an abnormal one, but perhaps there are ways to save it. With counseling, we can restore it to its proper the proper arrangement between the married spouses. Here, same thing is true. There can be states that approximate this very closely, states that approximate it almost not at all. There are some states that actually reverse this and have might determine what is right. In other words, it's just the most powerful, the people that are richest, that have the most influence, exercise control over the armed force, the military or the police, and then force anything that they want to be declared right and right in accordance with law. Laws can be unjust, just as people can be, and we know plenty of examples of that sort of thing. So we're saying that a state that's distorted in that way is still a state, but a deformed one. The truth is that many kinds of things are able to violate their type law to a great extent before they cease to be that type of thing. There's wiggle room, especially when norms are involved, normative behavior. And that's what we have here about rules of justice. The next thing we're going to notice is that Dewey Root adds to this that what God has built into the world in way of justice is the norm, the overarching law that we are to be just in our dealings with one another. So this differs from natural law theory that holds that somewhere, and it may be a Platonic dimension, some thinkers have put this into the mind of God, somewhere there is a set of perfect laws that govern every possible contingency here in creation. And our laws are just if and only if they copy those laws. Or put another way, they're just to the extent that they copy those laws that were in another realm altogether. Toyrig finds that excessively speculative. We're not told anything like that, or there is no hint in that direction in Scripture. Taking the norm of justice, that we are to treat one another as just, Doyrud's contention is that the elected officials of the state, the lawmakers, must then determine the set of laws that is most just for the most citizens that it can, and in most ways that it can. And that set of laws may differ from one time to another, one place to another. They can be different in one place and another place at the same time. It's not true that if you have a Christian point of view and you have a state that's closely corresponds to its type law, that you'll again get the same set of laws for everybody. No, that's not true. People live in different circumstances, have different needs, and so on. But one of the examples he gives of this is that during a time when the economy in Western Europe was pretty much barter, I trade you this for that, and very few people had any money. The Roman Empire had collapsed, and there were very hard times. The state, the church made it a rule that taking interest on money was wicked and evil. Doyrud says that was right. The only people that had money at all were extraordinarily wealthy, and for them to charge anyone else interest, charge the poor interest, it was a terrible case of usury. But after the monetary system shifted to, after the economic system shifted to being monetary, to having representational coins or whatever for the value that you are trading for. So I'm not trading this sheep for that goat, I'm not trading this cow for those pairs of shoes or whatever it is, but it actually the trade is in money. Money's in wide circulation. Then that proscription, that forbidding of taking usury, doesn't necessarily have to apply anymore. And that was Calvin's point. It didn't need to apply it. It was right when it was passed. Now it no longer is. So it's not that these laws, as the natural laws are envisioned by the people who hold that theory, the laws are eternal, immutable, they never change. A just society would be exactly the same in every place for all people. No, it varies very much with how people make their living, where they live. It varies with the climate and all kinds of other things that influence people's needs and which goods are scarce and can be given a monetary value and that needs to be governed by rules of justice. So for in any state, though, there are going to be organs of determining right. That might be the king's decree, but most of us nowadays think it's much better to elect lawmakers from the people, qualified people who can represent the people's interests and vote on laws and pass them. And then there are organs of enforcement. These include the military or for foreign matters that require force, and the police for domestic ones. Now, there is an old controversy in Christian thinking about whether the state is really a proper and necessary institution in human society, or whether it's only an ad hoc arrangement to restrain sin. This goes back to Augustine. Augustine thinks about it and he says, well, if there had never been a fall into sin, if humans hadn't rebelled against God, then it seemed to him we wouldn't need the state at all. We wouldn't need laws. We wouldn't need enforcement. And so he proposes what becomes an influential view about the state. That it's not natural to human life, it's only to restrain sin. All due respect to an esteemed thinker, I think he's not right about that. The state is not there just to punish evildoers. That's one of the things it's there for, but it's not the only one. And we are told that in God's final kingdom, his son will be the king who will rule. That's a political office. And who will bring forth justice for everyone. So I don't see that the state itself is unnecessary except for sin. It's going to even be in God's final kingdom. Someone's going to make the decisions about what's just, when and where. Conflicts people have. People may have honest conflicts. Nothing to do with sin. I'd like to know where my yard ends and your yard begins. My neighbor would like to know that too. But we have a way of finding out. There are record keepers. There are people that can calculate that and keep records. And that would be part of a state's duties, as it is now. I like what Jim Skillman, as the political philosopher from the United States, has to say about this point of Augustine's. Biblically speaking, Skillman says, family life was created by God for a positive, loving, nurturing, God-revealing purpose. Part of our identity as God's image is that we are the sons and daughters and frequently mothers and fathers. The family did not arise as a technical invention to spank bad children. Punishment and negative discipline are not the reason for the family. We recognize, of course, that due to sin, parents will have to incorporate punishment into the raising of their children in order to foster healthy families. But spankings or other forms of retribution fit the deeper, broader, and more original meaning of family life. They fit into that. They don't replace it. Life in political communities is quite different from family life, to be sure. I don't intend to describe civil family life, civic life, as family life writ large. Rather, the analogy is this: the purpose for government, the reason for political life, is not, first of all, to punish wrongdoers through police officers and trial lawyers in the military. Rather, the central meaning of political life is to be found in the positive reality of a public community that's there to foster healthy inner relationships of people through public legal means, so that commerce, family, life, agriculture, industry, science, art, education, and many other things can all be carried on at the same time in the same territory in a harmonious fashion. I think that's a wonderful way to put this point. And it's my reason for thinking that Augustine was wrong about that point, and Thomas Aquinas had it right instead, and many people since. And of course, we're talking about Kuyper and about Professor Duyberg saying that the state is part of human life. Of course, by saying that we have a different view of the state as Christians, we're referring to things like the social background in Kuyper's theory of sphere sovereignty. We're not saying we have a wholly new theory that isn't anything like anybody else's. No, we're saying that there are some ways the general view of what constitutes a state can be tightened up. It can be cleaned up from some errors and mistakes. And I think it might help if I give you just a simple example of what I mean. I'm going to refer now to the difference between civil law and criminal law. In civil law, if I accidentally do something that injures another person, I'm liable, I'm assessed a fine or something like that, in order to compensate this person for their loss. If through my own clumsiness I trip someone on the stairs and they break a leg, I am responsible for that and to see that I pay the doctor bills and that this person is healed. The odd part is that if I do it on purpose, if I deliberately trip somebody and they fall down the stairs and break their leg, then I'm arrested for assault and I may be jailed or punished in some other way. But the injured party isn't compensated at all. I hope that strikes you as loony. Why should it be that if I accidentally cause you injury, I pay for it, but if I do it on purpose as a criminal act, I don't pay you for it, instead I'm jailed by the state? I think what lies behind this blind spot in the civil law, between civil law and criminal law, is a false view of the state. I had it up on the board. I was just going to point to it, but I've erased it. I had it up on the board. There's one view that sees that authority originates in the state. And that's what's at work here. The reason that I'm punished by the state and pay my penalty to the state rather than the injured party is the view that the criminal law originates with the state. That's where the authority comes from, and the state is therefore the injured party. I've broken the state's law, so now I must pay for it. But I pay the state, not the victim, not the injured party. The law of Moses did better than that 3,000 years ago. But it comes out of this false view that the authority originates with the state. I made this point before, and you might think it sounds like nitpicking. On the Christian view, the authority in the state, or the home, or the school, or the business, or the marriage, comes from God. All authority originates with God. People may bear that authority if they're ordained clergy, if they start a business and own it. They may have that authority that parents have in the family because they marry and have children. They may bear authority, but they are not the originators of it. And what this difference in the way the law treats an accident from criminal activity has to do with regarding the state as the originator of that authority, so that the offended party is the state. So we even have the expression that if someone has been convicted of a crime and served a term and then is released, that person has paid their debt to society, where society is a synonym for the state. But the society isn't the injured party. The state wasn't injured when somebody broke that law. It was another human being that was injured who should have been compensated. We're going to have a lot of examples like that as we go through and expand on the Christian view of the state and then take a look at how what effect that would having that view would have on specific laws. But I hope this illustration is enough to get us started. When we come back, we'll go further into the nature of the state and look further at how our sphere sovereignty, biblical view that looks for its qualifying function and its type law placed in the context of sphere sovereignty would lead us to make laws differently.